Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, high-speed rail, a shakeup in the high-speed rail authority leadership and growing opposition. We will try to rise above the politics to get to the facts from the reporter who has been covering this story all along. At Fresno County Child Protective Services, under a microscope as legislation aimed at protecting children is put before legislators. The bill's author, Assemblyman Henry T. Perea, will join us to discuss the issue. And the germ. Want to know what it is? Stay tuned. But first, high-speed rail. Construction on the first leg of the proposed 520-mile rail system could begin construction late this year in Fresno, but a series of setbacks, including the resignation of the Rail Authority's top leadership, as well as rising cost of the project, are putting it in jeopardy. Fresno Bee business reporter Tim Sheehan has been covering this story from the beginning. Recently, he traveled to Spain to see firsthand how that country's high-speed rail system works and lessons to be learned from that country. Thanks so much for joining us, Tim. It's nice to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'd like to just have your impression of Spain's system. From what I read in your article, it seemed to be a very kind of luxurious kind of train system.
It's a sweet ride, that's for sure. Yeah, it's very comfortable. You don't get a sense of the speed until you look out the window and see things flashing by. It's smooth, it's comfortable, and it's not cheap, but it sure is a fast way to get around that country.
Now, when you say get around, I mean, they've been at this for more than 20 years, and they're still building it out, correct?
Absolutely, right. The first line from Madrid to Seville opened in 1992 to coincide with the World's Fair in Seville, or the World's Expo that was in Seville that year. And that line was the only line for quite some time, and they've since expanded to other cities like Malaga, Barcelona, Valencia. And so they are still expanding. Their goal was to connect each of the provincial capitals with Madrid by high-speed rail.
When you take a look at where Spain is and some of the other countries, mainly because they've been at this for so long, in reading your article, there didn't seem to be much organized opposition against this. Both party supported the country's high-speed rail program. As we mentioned, it continues to grow. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be fair to say that the process here has been very much political.
I think that's a fair statement. In the research that I did before I went over to Spain and talking with people while I was there, there wasn't a lot of upheaval. There wasn't a large wailing or gnashing of teeth as we see over here about the construction or about the process. And it's a little difficult to comprehend after you're seeing what we're experiencing here to go over there and not find the same level of controversy.
Could it be possibly that what we're seeing here too, because when the project first started, we didn't hear a lot of opposition, but now we're seeing this opposition, and it is for the most part, not all, but for the most part, right down party lines. So is this part of what we see happening in Washington and at our state capitol, that again, you have two parties that just won't come together on something?
It certainly has that feel. It smells that way, certainly, here in California and in the U.S. It's probably a little bit too broad a brush to say the Republicans are against it and the Democrats are for it. But I think by and large, that's how it seems to break out. But I think there are legitimate questions that the people who are against this have. They have legitimate concerns, and the backers have not necessarily been the most articulate at addressing some of those concerns, particularly the rail authority itself.
And as you mentioned, even though when you look at the way even the high-speed rail peer review committee that was set up by Governor Schwarzenegger, and it just released, you know, a report, or it is urging legislators not to appropriate the bond money. Mm-hmm. And as you said, there are some real concerns. But even I went back and looked at the peer committee, and there's nobody from the Central Valley on the right. peer committee. They're all from Southern California, San mm-hmm. Diego for the most part, and one, you know, like from Orange County. So, again, you still can take a look at that and say, you know, there is a lot of opposition to a starting the first leg being built here in the Central Valley.
Sure. And whether or not one wants to cynically take the view that that's because there's money at stake, you know, that may indeed be a part of it. You know, that's for others to figure out.
Okay. But as you mentioned, the High Speed Rail Authority has made some missteps and
yes.
some mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think has hurt the not only the organization, but just the whole process at this point?
I think probably the biggest thing is for a couple of years, the Rail Authority stuck steadfastly to this price tag of $45 billion when it was clear that there was no way it was going to be able to be accomplished for that price. And so there was a great deal of sticker shock, naturally, when on November 1st they released the new business plan. And lo and behold, here's this $98.5 billion price tag, almost double what they'd been sticking to for the last 2 years. And last summer when I had a chance to interview Roelof van Ark, the CEO who's now on his way out the door, I asked him about that. I said, yeah, how realistic is this? And he acknowledged at that time, you know, that there was going to be an increase, that perhaps the previous business plan from 2009 was – I think, to put it charitably, overly optimistic in its projections for both price and other factors.
And I did read, and please correct me if I'm wrong with this, that part of the authority's problem from the very beginning was that it was never like fully funded. So the authority went out and hired a bunch of consultants,
mm-hmm.
and we've read and seen firsthand the disaster with the PR firm they hired. And I think it would be fair to say that part of their problem, they've kind of lost the PR campaign or war there.
Yes. There was a great deal of criticism by some prior or past authority members about the PR firm and that maybe that firm didn't do enough to try to get ahead of the game and get ahead of the arguments. And I think that's probably a fair perception.
But one of the things that you said – and then I got from your article is just how the people in Spain embraced this whole project. And we'd like to run a clip.
Okay, sure.
Now, this is from, I think, one of the interviews there on just how the people feel about having high-speed
yes,
rail.
This was an engineer in Barcelona that I spoke with.
Okay.
It was kind of a wonderful feeling of becoming modernized mm-hmm. so soon. The experience of using the high-speed train line when you used to use the bus system or a very poor railway, the difference is amazing. So people were very, very happy and still are very, very happy.
Mm-hmm. And that's Andrew Uliad, and his engineering firm in Barcelona is named MCrete. He does a lot of work doing transportation and project analysis both in Spain and for the European Union. And I was trying to get a sense from him of why I wasn't finding the level of opposition, that the level of controversy that we've seen here in the U.S. And that was part of his explanation, is that they really have embraced it as a symbol of a modern nation.
And for us, there, like you said, there's been a lot of doubt about, you know, this is something we just can't afford to do right now. And is the, you know, train going to nowhere and all of these different things, instead of taking a look at, okay, we're trying to undertake this massive project. And sure, there will be problems, but overall, we kind of want to see the country move forward with a new kind of transportation system, and mm-hmm. that you don't hear that.
You don't hear that here because – and we didn't – you know, I think part of the big difference, and we outlined it in one of the articles that appeared last weekend, was that Spain started – when Spain undertook its project, it started in economic conditions that were far different than what Spain has now and what we're seeing in the U.S. now. They had – they had the money available. They had the will. And so they had the means, they had the money, they had the will, and they did it.
And I would also have to say that part of our problem, too, right now, as you said, Spain started this whole project in a time when at a time of economic prosperity, and there were no problems. And you have to look at the country and where we are with the economy, and especially in California.
Definitely.
And so I would assume that that's probably
– I think that's obviously a big piece of the puzzle here, and it is playing a factor in Spain now as you're starting to see people say – we love our system, but right now maybe it's time to start slowing down on this spending until our economy improves.
Right. But also part of the thing that we're hearing here mm-hmm. is that, oh, not only should we do this because we have the money now, and it's my understanding that if we don't use that money, we kind of lose it
right.
in a way, and that we have this money and a great opportunity, so we should find a way to kind of move forward, and it's looking – it's also being taken as a way to help the economy grow.
That's right. The concern that you hear a lot is out of the entire $98 billion price tag, the $3 billion that the feds have committed to this process is not a huge chunk, and there's no guarantees that the federal government is going to contribute more. California's bond money can only be used to match other money. So if there's no other money forthcoming, that becomes the conundrum. If you only build as much as you can build with the $3 billion from the feds and a matching $3 billion from Prop 1A, the 2008 bond measure, that gets you from point A to point B. But the ends of this thing that have the population to support the ridership are points C and D at either end of the state. So that becomes the situation. I think there's a legitimate concern about wanting to make sure there's going to be future funding for it.
Now, in Spain, the majority of the money came from where?
A lot of it came from Spain's treasury, and a lot of it came from the European Union. The European Union has a policy of trying to promote – and I want to make sure I get this right. It's called TEN-T, which is Trans-European Network Transportation. So they're trying to promote a unified transportation system throughout Europe, and Spain has been the beneficiary of a good number of euros from that.
Okay, now is a good time to sort of invite our listeners out there if they have any questions about high speed rail. We'd like to know what you think. Why do you think the time now is to move forward, or do you think it should be maybe postponed until the economy gets better, or why do you feel there's so much opposition? You can give us a call at 800-224-8989, 559-275-8989, or online at kbpr.org. We've got somebody who knows the subject very well. It'd be a great opportunity for you to ask some questions. Now, just as in Spain, their rail system also went through a lot of farmland. Mm-hmm. And here in the Central Valley, a lot of the opposition we see is coming from the rural areas, and it is coming from farmers and growers.
Right.
And in Spain, you had people who lived in the rural areas. We have another clip I want you to hear, and this is something that I think that you can set up.
Sure. One of the days that I was there, I traveled from Madrid or from Seville back to Madrid, and we stopped at a farm and interviewed a farming couple who live right on the tracks. Their house is about 100 feet from the high-speed train tracks.
Luis Valciente and his wife, Mercedes Martin, own a small farm about 20 miles northeast of Seville near the town of Brenes. When they bought their property in 1989, tracks for regular passenger and freight trains already ran behind the backyard. High-speed tracks for AVE trains came along a couple of years later, running about 100 feet from the rear of their home. AVE trains between Madrid and Seville pass by several times an hour. Here's what that sounds like.
One of the things that they said is that the AVE trains, the high-speed rail trains, move so quickly, they're loud, sure, but the noise passes so quickly and dissipates quickly, they're bothered less by the AVE trains than they are by the slower commuter trains.
Mm. Like the FATE trains.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, we have Mark in Bakersfield. Your question, Mark.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's sort of a matter of historical perspective. The establishment of a rail network for the development and expansion of the country was vital, and the government participated by making land grants to developers, by making laws favorable for private development of railroads. But the U.S. government didn't expand our rail network by building railroads. I'm wondering how it became the responsibility and exclusive domain of the government to do passenger rail. And I know it goes back to Amtrak and everything else. There is very little private passenger rail in the country anymore. So if the market supports it, if there is a need, if there's demand, and it's economically justifiable, there should be passenger rail developed by people who are willing to make a profit on it. And the government should help make that process possible. But, again, why are the taxpayers responsible for this? Rail in Spain worked because they always had rail. They always had mass transit. They always had bus transportation. They didn't have 2.3 cars per person. That's not California. And what you know, we have too many cars. We have too many cars on the road. No question about it. But that's a culture that isn't going to change just because the government plugs a bunch of dollars into a rail system that nobody wants.
That's a fair point, and the ridership, the demand is something that is very much up for debate. The High Speed Rail Authority has put out its ridership projections, and there's not a lot of people who put a whole lot of faith in those. Among some of the research that I've found is that there was substantially more passenger rail here in the United States that was offered by the private railroads. Until the interstate highway system was developed and made it much easier to get around in private vehicles. And so that's when I think you started to see the demise of passenger rail here in the United States. But, of course, not everybody has a vehicle. So the government saw fit to put passenger rail under Amtrak, and that's the service that we have today. On Amtrak, you can get from Los Angeles to San Francisco. It's going to take you between 9 and 12 hours. Which is substantially different than what's proposed for high-speed rail. In Spain and through much of Europe, the government or the passenger rail services the railroad lines, the infrastructure is owned by the government. It's not owned by private railways like we see here in the U.S., Union Pacific or Santa Fe. And in Spain, the government essentially runs the passenger rail system. Renfe, the company that provides the passenger service, is a government-owned company, and Adif, the company that manages the infrastructure, is also a government-owned company. So both pieces fall under the Ministry of Public Works in Spain.
Okay.
Well, I should probably point out that I am biased. I really do like the idea of rail transportation, high-speed or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter works for high-speed rail in the U.K.,
mm-hmm.
I've always been a railroad buff. The idea that mass transportation for long distances, or medium distances, I should say, should be on rail works very well for me. But unless we're willing to make it painful to use your car for that same distance, rail's not going to work. As far as the government owning the infrastructure, yes, that is the way it works every place else. And if we were to, and believe me, I wouldn't want it, if we were to nationalize the SP and the Union Pacific and the Santa Fe and all the rail lines that are there, and use that right away, that infrastructure, to build up to high-speed rail, it would, A, be a lot less expensive, and B, a lot less invasive. But that's not the world we're in.
Right.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mark. We appreciate your insight as well. But I think what he said is so true. We're a car culture, and it's going to take a lot to get people away from that. And we also have to deal with the consequences of being a car culture, too.
Sure. And he makes a good point about it having to be painful. And in Spain, it is a lot more painful to to drive a private vehicle because gasoline, when I filled up the little rental car that I had, gas prices were around the $7, equated to about $7 a gallon. I forget what the price per liter was, but it worked out when I did the math to, I think, about $7.10 a gallon. So considerably more expensive to buy
and,
fuel
and,
there.
And I think that's part of what you're saying. It's just going to have to become a little bit more difficult for us just to hop in our cars and go down the highway. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Nancy from Wonder Valley with a question.
Yes, hi, sir. I'm really interested in high-speed rail. I have lived in Los Angeles. I've lived now in a rural area, and I am astounded that there's so much opposition to this when I've only been in Fresno 3 years, and the air quality here is pathetic. It's horrible. And we breathe air from other cars in other cities. And I just cannot believe that there's so much opposition. Because one of the main reasons is because of our air quality. I guess my question is how we got from our car culture, from what I understand, is a lot of suppression of mass transit. I mean, all the way back to the 50s in L.A. when Disney wanted to build a monorail and the car companies came in and suppressed all this. And this is what we're dealing with now as a result. I just would like to know what we can do to help people change their minds and look at the bigger picture. Look at the air the children are breathing. Look at the asthma so many children and adults have. And look at the bigger picture and have some vision about what this high-speed rail could do.
I'm not sure I have an answer for that.
That's a big question.
You know, people are going to have to be motivated by whatever will motivate them. In some cases, you're not going to get people out of their cars. I know when I've driven to Sacramento to cover the authorities' meetings, I find myself in my car on a 3-hour drive to Sacramento, and I look around on the freeway and I see probably 80% of the vehicles, one person in one car on the freeway making a long drive, whether it's to the Bay Area or San Francisco. So obviously that contributes to the air quality, and also it speaks to the strength of the car culture. And whether or not the high-speed rail bond money gets released by the legislature this year in time to use the federal funds or not, is probably a very small piece of the question compared to what you're talking about, Nancy, as far as are people ready to adopt any sort of mass transportation, whether it's high-speed rail, whether it's bus rapid transit, which is being talked about here in Fresno, or any other type of mass transportation to reduce the number of vehicles on the road.
And
if I want more involved, I'm sorry, I just want to ask one more question. If I want to get more involved in what's going on with high-speed rail, where would I go to attend meetings and such, get more information?
The High Speed Rail Authority publicizes its meetings on its website, and their meetings are usually held in different parts around the state. Last month's meeting was in Los Angeles. Most of the meetings I've attended have been in Sacramento. They have had public hearings here in Fresno last year when they unveiled the environmental impact reports. But if one is so inclined to either support or oppose, probably the best place to go would be the local legislators, because they're the ones who are going to be making the next key decisions on this.
Yeah, that's what I was going to suggest, Nancy, is, contact your local legislator and say, look, hey, how can I get involved? We have another question we're going to take here. And thanks so much, Nancy, for your time. We now have Paul from Tranquility. Paul?
I'm a fan of trains. I ride them here. I've been on the trains in Spain. My wife's been on the trains and the bullet train in Japan. To me, the costs seem comparable to airfare, so why should we build a train system when the cost and speed are comparable to air? And I haven't heard anybody answer that question. What do you think, Tim?
Well, I know in talking with passengers on the train systems and talking with passengers or talking with people in Madrid, Seville, Valencia, Barcelona, one of the uniform things that I was being told was the convenience of high-speed rail, that they like the convenience of being able to go to the train station, get there 10 minutes ahead, simply run their luggage through the X-ray machine and be in their seat and not have to get there an hour and a half, 2 hours ahead. They like the fact that they have leg room. You can spread out on the train, and you can also work on the train. The cell phones will work just fine on the high-speed trains, unlike not being able to use your cell phones on airplanes here. So there's a combination of factors, and the longer the distance, the less the payoff in terms of the comfort and speed. So there's sort of a sweet spot of between 100 and 500 miles from what I'm told and from my research, where high-speed rail has the benefits over air travel and over taking a private vehicle. There's sort of a sweet spot there.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling in. And Tim, one more question for you.
Sure.
We've seen these changes with the high-speed the Rail Authority Board. Governor Brown seems to be getting more involved, because when you look at it, I think you pointed out that if we don't use the federal money, then it's gone.
Right.
And I think that the concern people who support high-speed rail have is that if you lose that money and if you don't do it now, it's not going to get done.
Right. The thing that supporters say is, yeah, we have this opportunity. We have the money from the federal government that we can match with this for a pot of $6 billion. Yes, the price is high. The argument goes, yes, the price is high. It's not going to get any cheaper if we wait.
And that's part of the problem. Maybe if you would have done it 20 years ago, it may have cost the money.
It might have actually been the $33 billion that was being talked about when Prop 1A was passed, if we'd done this in prosperous economic times and say 15, 20 years ago.
What did you take away from your trip to Spain and the contrast that you saw, from what you saw there and what's going on here?
The big contrast was the lack of controversy. I mean, that is the thing that really stood out to me after covering this for a year and a half here, going over there and seeing the level of uniformity of public support was a little surprising to me. Some of the experts, a lot of the economists and experts are cautious about the amount of money that's been spent and the amount of money that is continuing to be spent given the state of Spain's economy. But the government has made up its mind that it's plunging ahead with it.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to be discussed, especially when it comes to California and the way they seem to handle mm-hmm. big projects. Anyway, Tim Sheehan from the Fresno Bee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming in. And as you see, we have a lot more to discuss. So we'd love to have you back from time to time.
Sure.
Especially when it comes to this issue. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. An audit of child protective service agencies in Fresno County, Sacramento, and Alameda counties turned up some disturbing findings and has resulted in legislation introduced by Fresno Assemblyman Henry T. Perea. Assemblyman Perea joins us now to discuss the audit and his proposed legislation. Mr. Perea, first of all, thanks so much for joining us this morning. You're talking to us from Sacramento, so I know that you're going to have to go in a minute, but thanks for taking your time out to talk with us on this issue.
Sure, no problem. It's my pleasure.
Okay. One, we kind of all remember the death of 10-year-old Seth Arlen about 3 years ago. And the tragedy here was that CPS was made aware of the danger Seth faced, but there was no action. It's my understanding that it was that case that really caused you to move forward and to act.
It was. I mean, it was the case that really piqued my interest into the world of CPS agencies and what that means. And what we've learned is that it's a very complicated world. And so one of the things we wanted to do to bring some clarity into issues that may exist within CPS agencies is we requested an audit last year of several CPS agencies throughout the state. And one of the findings that came out of that audit was the fact that CPS agencies across the state are very inconsistent with how they conduct child death reviews. Some counties did okay. Fresno did 4 out of 5. Sacramento did 9 out of 15. Alameda County did 0 child death reviews during the period of the audit, which was 2008 and 2010. And so when one of the agencies was asked, well, why are you not doing these audits, by the auditor, the response was, well, there's no law that requires us to do it. So in response to that, I've introduced AB 1440, which would require counties, all counties across the state, to conduct these child death reviews, because I think we can learn a lot from them. I think we have these in-depth reviews that would allow us to learn where the deficiencies are within the system so that we can protect children in the future from meeting similar fates that others, like Seth Ireland, have met in the past.
Now, doesn't Fresno County already have, you know, some kind of review process of deaths of children in the system?
They do, and I think that Fresno County, again, was part of the audit, and it showed that they reviewed 4 of the 5 deaths that had occurred within the time span of the audit, which was 2008-2010. I think they should have done all 5, and they have since changed their internal policy to do all child death reviews when a child has contact with CPS. So I think that's a good step in the right direction. But not every county does it the same way. And so I think it's important that all counties are required to do these child death reviews so we can learn from the mistakes that have been made.
Now, how are you hoping this piece of legislation will change things? As you mentioned, you said hopefully the agencies will start taking a look at what they're doing wrong and trying to correct it. But, you know, what you hear from so many social service agencies is that, you know, our workers are overworked. We don't have enough people and on and on and on. So how do you deal with that side of the issue as well?
Well, you know, I think that's the case for virtually every governmental department these days, is that there are fewer and fewer resources considering the economic times that we're in. But it doesn't mean that the services that we provide should diminish. It means that we just have to do more with less. We have to be creative with how we do our jobs and making sure that we are providing the best services possible, especially when it comes to our children. So while I understand there are challenges, I don't think that we can use that as an excuse to not try to do our jobs better. And that goes for all of us. And so I think that these child death reviews, AB 1440, is the first step. We need to do the reviews. The second step really is making sure that when there are recommendations made from these reviews, that they actually get implemented. One of the other findings in the audit was that while some counties are doing the reviews, the recommendations are not being fully implemented. And so that's step two, really, in making sure that counties are following their own advice.
Okay. And I know that you have to go, you have some work, but where is this legislation? Do you expect it to pass?
You know, I'm hearing good things. I'm getting calls on a daily basis from my colleagues asking to sign on as co-authors. So that's a good sign. But of course, it's we're at the beginning of the process. We have many steps along the way, and it is my hope that we will begin to gain support from counties, including Fresno, for our effort to make sure that we keep kids safe.
Okay. Thank you so much, Assemblyman Henry T. Perea from Fresno, joining us this morning to talk about legislation aimed at helping to protect children. Thank you for your time, Henry.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. And we're going to continue with this discussion because the audit also turned up some other information. And here to discuss that with us is Dr. Mort is it Rosenstein or Rosenstein?
Rosenstein.
Rosenstein. He's the committee chair of Foster Care Standards Oversight Committee. And Kathy Huerta, former director of Fresno County Social Services. She is now a board member of Fresno County Child Protective Services. Now, the audit also turned up other information in that there were registered sex offenders were living in homes with foster kids or near foster kids. How does something like that happen?
Well, I think the particular case there was that there was an individual who people, the investigators where these are all checked out, did not realize this person was living in the home for some reason. The other way is I think there's has been some concern is which lists people are checking against, whether there's two lists. There's one of registered sex offenders, and there's also a list dealing with Megan's Law. And I think there are differences in the people that do show up in this. And I think that as the number that were reported from the three counties, I think with Fresno there was just the one case that was encountered.
The other piece about it is those lists are cross-checked at a point in time. And so I think the corrective action to that, and I know that this is being looked at, I'm not in the department anymore, but they're looking, is that these lists need to be cross-checked on a regular basis. They need – so that any time, for example, a name is added to a sex offender list, that is actually played against all of the homes that are licensed in a county. Because at any given point in time, you can actually go through and you can do a cross-check. It can turn out to be nobody, so to speak. The next day, somebody moves into a home, and unless that person reports that person there. So it's a matter of being able to make it not so much a manual process but an automatic process.
Okay. Now, Doctor, you are a member of the Foster Care Standards and Oversight Committee. What does that committee do? What is the role of that committee?
This committee was started, I think, in 2002 in response to some of the problems that were going on with the department. That was the time when there were the motel kids, there were placements, young people staying at offices, and this committee was established at that time sort of in response to a grand jury report that had been issued at that time. The committee consists of three members appointed by each supervisor and a member of the Board of Supervisors. The role of this committee has changed very markedly. This was started as a reactive committee because of these problems, and in subsequent developments has turned into a severely proactive committee. We deal with – we have three subcommittees dealing with education, mental health, and recruitment and development of social workers. And these committees are made up of members of the Oversight Committee, members from the Department of Social Services, and other community members. And they are working to keep up, make sure that the information that comes down, such as relating to education changes and other changes to the department, are communicated and implemented.
Now, there is also a subcommittee that does investigate serious injury or death of children here in Fresno County. Do you think it's been effective? Because as you just heard, Assemblyman Henry T. Perea, that's something that he's trying to get passed because not every county does it. So I guess you want to have something that is uniform. But do you think that process works here?
Well, I think every case is investigated by myself and another member of the committee. And I've been involved with doing these investigations for many, many years. There's also another committee not dealing with the department, there's a pediatric death review board that works through the coroner's office. And there are members of the Department of Social Services there that any deaths that are investigated by that committee, contact or any contact with social services is noted, and those reports are then made back.
Now, Kathy, when you were the director of Fresno County Social Services, did the review process help you all in doing your work? Did you actually go back and review them and try to see what you could learn from them?
Yes, we did. I mean, that review process started when I was the director, working right alongside Dr. Rosenstein and the Foster Care Oversight Committee. And we made a commitment that we would review every child death. Assemblyman Perea said that we reviewed 4 out of 5. Reality is we did review 5 out of 5, but there was not a written report on the one death because there were no recommendations. And at that point in time, the only time there was a written report to the director is if there were recommendations or concerns. So we've changed that policy, and now we will do a written report for every single child's death. But we've been doing this for several years, even before the audit. And it's because we always believe to lose a child in a child welfare system is the worst thing that can possibly happen. So, you know, we believe that there are always things that we can do to improve, and that we at least owe it to be able to do a complete investigation and make those changes.
And you were also the director at the time with the Ireland case. And, you know, one of the criticism was is that CBS had been made aware that this child was in danger, not just CBS, the Sheriff's Department. And at that there were also a few other high-profile cases where children died in their homes, and CPS had been out to investigate. I mean, how do you explain that? What goes wrong in a situation like that?
You know, I don't know if we want to say goes wrong. I think that child welfare workers, just like law enforcement, work with the information that they have. And not always do they have all the information. I think after something horrible happens, tragic happens, and you go back and review, you can see things that you should have known, or you had you been in communication with other agencies, you might have known. And I think some of the recommendations that came out of the Seth Ireland case were to figure out how to make those communications with other agencies happen on a more normal occurrence so that we have that information. The Seth Ireland case was actually reviewed 4 times, the audit being the last time. So it certainly had – we were open from day one. We were open to every kind of a review because we wanted to be able to make changes and any kind of changes that were recommended by the different reviewers.
Now that you have left the agency and you retired, and when you look back at the system, you know, what are some of the problems you see and that you had to deal with, and what – changes do you think need to be made if you can talk to that issue?
Well, I don't – I mean, I see the same thing as I saw as a director. Nothing changed stepping away. You know, I'm still very committed to the work that agency does. I strongly believe that children need to be a priority in this community and a lot of decisions that are being made. My former department thoroughly endorses this bill. We're very supportive of it. I know Assemblyman Perea made comment that he hoped we would, Fresno would. Well, Fresno does, at least from a department perspective. Because I think when you work in a field such as child welfare, children, things happen. That's why we're here. And we want to do everything we can to prevent children being hurt. I'll tell you what I think there's wrong. I think there's something wrong with the system in which a child has to be hurt to have any kind of attention paid. I think we don't put enough of our energies and our resources into preventing children from being hurt. It just says something. I mean, why does a child have to be hurt for services to be provided to a family? And yet in the reality, that's what happens. And that's something I wish we could change.
Go ahead, Doctor.
I think one other thing that's been instituted by Kathy is that as far as the response to these reports – is that now there are meetings held called roundtables, and this brings together all of the people who are involved with the case, the social worker, the supervisors, the leadership in the department, and members of the oversight committee. And each of these reviews is done very in-depth and very thorough, and this provides an opportunity for changes to be addressed and to be brought up in regard to the recommendations made by the reviewers.
How big of a factor is, and we've seen it not just in Fresno County, but every county, when it's time to cut social services and the services provided to children, take a huge hit.
Well, I agree with Assemblyman Perea's statement that resources are very limited and everybody's taking hits. I think, and I agree with the fact that you've got to work smarter, you've got to get creative, and I think Fresno County has done a phenomenal job in trying to do that. But the bottom line is, if you lose your staff, if you lose your resources, which are your social workers that are on the line, that are out there making those responses in terms of children being neglected or hurt, you're going to it's going to impact. It is going to impact. There's no way around it. You know, Fresno believes very strongly that safety is a priority. I believe that safety is a priority. I live in this community. But I believe child welfare plays a major role in providing safety for the children of this community.
But also when you talked about social workers, and one of the things the Assemblyman brought up is better training for social workers.
Well, I think training needs to be an ongoing factor. I think that and that is an expense. That is something that, you know, when you're bringing in training programs, you have to have the resources and the funds to do that. I think when funds are limited, those resources, whether it's going to be in having a social worker out on the street responding to calls at an appropriate time or paying for training, sometimes you have to make difficult decisions. But I don't think you quit looking for ways to get that training in. We work very closely with the university, and we have ongoing training for our social workers. Our social workers are required to have a bachelor's degree. Many of our social workers have master's degrees in the social work. So they are educated. We don't have a program in which we don't require the education in the field. But training needs to be done on a consistent and constant basis.
But I think one of the other things, too, that we really do have to address here in Fresno County, and all these statistics bear it out. Why do we have so many children in this county who are at risk? Whether it's at risk of dropping out of school, whether it's at risk of going hungry, whether it's at risk when it comes to abuse. Why do we have so many kids here in that situation?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, the demographics of the area. We have a lot of transient people. We have people in lower socioeconomic groups. We have people that are tend to be more involved with drugs, with alcohol, with family violence. All of these things lead to increased problems that require children to be removed from their home. And you know, to ultimately clear up the social problems in the community, which we are looking for, we'd like to see done on many, many levels, would potentially have an increase or decrease in the need for children to be removed from their homes.
And Dr. Rosenstein said it. Poverty is a huge issue. The number of people that are living with below the rate of poverty in this community is higher than in most counties. And it, you know, when families are under stress because they don't have work and they can't find jobs, unfortunately, some families deal with that stress and by finding a means, whether it be substance abuse or alcohol, when they make those choices, that impacts their children. I think all of us know how we are when we're under a great deal of stress. And if we're not having our basic needs, if we can't meet our own family's basic needs, there's nothing that creates a higher stress level in a family than wondering where the next meal's coming from, wondering whether you're going to be able to pay your rent or your home's going to be foreclosed on because you can't find a job. These are huge factors. It doesn't mean that child abuse just happens in those socioeconomic groups because child abuse happens everywhere. But it's a huge indicator, and I think it points to some of the statistics in Fresno, why they're so high.
Yes, and it's a huge problem. It's something that's going to take a lot to address because you're talking about addressing the problem, you know, at its core and the bottom up, and there that costs a lot of money, and it takes a commitment, and that is a continuing problem here. So Dr. Mort Rosenstein and Kathy Huerta, former director of Fresno County Social Services. Thank you both for being here to discuss this important issue. It's not going to go away, and we'll probably have to continue talking about it. But thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. The germ. Do you know what that is? It's not what you think. It's all about being creative, and it's really catching on here in Fresno. I'm joined by Byron Rawkins. He's the creative director of Windsong Production. Thanks for coming in, Brian.
Thank you.
Okay, first, the germ. People want to know what that is.
Yeah, so at Windsong, we were sitting around one day, and we were talking about projects and being creative and the stuff that we like to do. And we sort of realized that it's when you like to create stuff, it's really difficult without a deadline or a box to kind of create something in. It's very difficult sometimes to motivate yourself to actually do something.
Yes, us creative types, we're kind of guilty of that. You got to give us a deadline.
We realize, like, we do work for clients, and a deadline always is sort of the thing that sort of kicks us into finishing the thing. And, you know, then we have personal projects that sort of wallow along all the time, or, you know, whatever you are, a painter or whatever it might be, you're constantly looking at the blank canvas going like, I need to just do that. And you're constantly kicking yourself. So we just felt like, what if we kind of created a space for people who like to create using video as a medium to give you a deadline and kind of a box to play in, and we call that the germ. And, and then allow people to kind of submit things to it so we could kind of all create things together. And I think the hope is that, you know, the germ kind of inspires people to create, and then really coming to the event brings people together, kind of look at everything else that everyone's created. I can't talk.
Okay, we'll drink some water while I ask this other question. Now, we'll kind of explain what the germ is. I know that you kind of create like your own film or video, but there aren't a lot of rules, but there are a few parameters here that you kind of stick to.
Sure. So each time, the plan is to kind of do the germ four times a year. We're going to stick with this first year and kind of see how it goes. The first one is actually the due date was on Monday, and the viewing party is going to be on this Thursday. And basically each time we will give you a germ. So it'll be a piece of inspiration, some kind of limiter, and then a time limit to fit in. So for this current one, the inspiration was red. But the limiter was the color red could not appear anywhere in your piece.
Okay.
And with a time limit of 3 minutes. So really each time we do it, the inspiration could be completely different. Maybe it'll be a photograph or a piece of music or, a poem. It could be really anything that we give you the inspiration point, and then we'll make up some kind of thing that creates a box, like not being able to use red.
Now, can anybody participate, or is this already a group of creative people who've just kind of come together to do this?
No, it's sort of a small group of us that started it, and it's really for anyone who would like to create something. I think, you don't have to be a filmmaker to do it. It's just that we'd sort of decided video would kind of be the medium to do that. So say that you're, for instance, if you were a poet and the inspiration piece kind of inspired you to write something, you could perform that poem on video. And I think the idea is when you come together to watch everybody's piece, you're going to see how different or how similar people have made things. And the idea being kind of open to how everyone interpreted the same single idea and how that can inspire you to kind of create other things.
Okay. Now, you talked a little bit about the first project and the parameters they were given. And that is something about create something using red,
yeah.
I think it was. Now, when do they come together and where? Because this is your first one. Where's the viewing going to be?
Yeah, the viewing will be at Windsong Productions, which is at 7676 North Palm, Suite 104. It's going to be on Thursday night. The films will start showing at 7, but we'll start gathering around 6. We have a taco truck showing up. And we've got a no-host bar so people can kind of hang out. And then at 7, we'll start showing the films.
Okay. A lot of people are going to show up because of the taco truck.
Yeah, right?
And some good food. But and also, if people want to get involved, how do they get involved in this whole project?
Well, it's going to be fun. So the hope is to do it quarterly. So our next one will be, I'm blanking on the date, but should be in April. And that'll be on our website. So go to thegerm.org and you can find out the stuff there. On Thursday night, we will announce the next germ. So we'll announce the next germ, and then there's basically, you have this quarter to produce or come up with your own idea to submit for the next one.
Now, the germ, is this like a national kind of thing?
It's not. It's just something we sort of started. We kind of came up with the idea probably late summer and started milling over how we would create it. And we actually sort of launched the initial framework on the website on December 1st. So really its impetus is only probably publicly about 2 months old. So it's really not, hasn't been around that long.
Wow, that sounds great. And it's not only that, it's an outlet for people who are creative and like to create through video.
Yeah, and, for sure. And I hope it just, our hope is just that it creates some creativity. We like to make things and we know other people do, and it just gives people a chance to kind of connect in a way that's a little bit different and hopefully give just something else to do in Fresno. So.
Okay. Yeah. So if you're interested, again, Thursday night at
6 o'clock
at
Windsong Productions. Yeah. You can find all the info on thegerm.org.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Byron, for coming in and telling us about the germ.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay. We'd like to. And if the projects, are they going to be up on the website?
Yes. On the germ, once they have the event, we'll post all of the videos online. So if you don't get to make it to the event, you can come see all of the germs on the website.
Okay. Byron Watkins here with Windsong Productions talking about the germ. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.